Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor at Cure Talk Blog and the Cure Panel Talk Show, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on yoga. Today is the third episode in our series of talks focusing on research and practice of yoga for addressing health and wellness. We previously had Dr. Satbir Khalsa of Harvard University, who discussed the research being done in his lab using yoga as a therapy for different conditions and evaluating the benefits in clinical research studies. In the previous show, we hosted David Emerson from the Justice Research Institute, who talked about his experience of using yoga to treat patients with trauma. In today's show, we have a very distinguished expert joining us to talk about an important topic that applies to millions of Americans and even more worldwide. Joining him is our panel of four experienced and distinguished yoga teachers. And towards the end of the show, we will be addressing questions received by our listeners. With that, I will hand over the talk to our co-host and resident yoga practitioner, Sharib Khan. Sharib, you're on air.
Thank you so much, Priya. And it's always an honor and it's always wonderful to be on the Cure Panel Talk Show and talk about something that's personal and so important in my life personally, having practiced yoga for the last 8 years. So today we're very excited to continue the discussion in our yoga series as part of Cure Panel, and we have a very distinguished guest expert today, Dr. Larry Payne, who's an internationally respected yoga teacher and back specialist. The LA Times named Larry as one of America's most respected yoga teachers, and he's co-authored several books, including Yoga Therapy, Yoga for Dummies, and The Business of Teaching Yoga. Dr. Payne actually received his doctorate in fitness education with an emphasis in Hatha Yoga from Pacific Western University. And he wears several hats, or should I say, does a delicate balancing act between many professional roles. He is the founding president of the International Association of Yoga Therapists, founder of the corporate yoga program at the J. Paul Getty Museum. He's the co-founder of the yoga curriculum at UCLA School of Medicine, so really bringing yoga into the medical environment and into higher professional education environments, and the founding director of the new yoga therapy certification program at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He's also the first yoga teacher to offer yoga classes at the World Economic Forum, really bringing yoga to the forefront of the corporate masters of the world, as they say in the Wall Street speak. And this is personally very exciting for me additionally because he's also met some of the absolute grand masters of yoga in the last 100 years, including Krishnamacharya. And we'll definitely touch upon this later in the talk show. So Dr. Payne, very hearty welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. And you'll be joined by four other distinguished and experienced yoga teachers in our panel today and discussing a very important topic that I think really applies, as Priya mentioned, to millions of people in America, but also worldwide. And as yoga is becoming more popular, one may misleadingly assume that it's actually for people who are fit and young, you know, given all the glossy portrayals in media publications showcasing young practitioners holding breathtaking poses in even more spectacular locations. One can all, you know, one in 50s and 60s and beyond can assume that yoga is something out of their grasp. Well, we do know that age is no barrier, and ample proof of that was demonstrated by Diana Nayad, who finally crossed the Florida Strait at the age of 64 after four failed attempts just a few days ago. So we're going to talk to Dr. Payne about how yoga is not only doable by people in their 50s and beyond, but might actually keep them healthy and have greater vitality and provide therapeutic value for several conditions as they progress in their journey. So with that, Dr. Payne, let's begin our conversation today. And I wanted to start the talk with actually talking about your own personal experience of how you started yoga with your own problems with back pain and chronic stress in 1979.
Well, first of all, sir, thank you so much for that great build-up. That makes me feel like I must be old by now.
Well, that certainly wasn't the intention. We have to do justice to this.
Thank you, and also to all the other people on the panel, and some of them are my friends. Dashima is a friend. My introduction was with lower back pain. And at the time, in another lifetime, I was the West Coast manager of advertising sales for McCall's magazine, which was a big magazine. And I can remember the pressure of that job. And I went to a lot of places to fix my back, and nobody could do it. And then somebody dragged me to a yoga class. And I'll never forget it. And unfortunately, the woman was very compassionate. She was older and, you know, wasn't pushy or anything like that. And at the end of the class, the back pain I had for almost 2 years, like a dog bite in my back, was gone. And it lasted for about 4 or 5 hours. So I knew I was on to something, and that's how it started.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So talking about, you know, yoga for the older people, older adults, elderly, what do you think currently are the misperceptions that people in this demographic age group have about yoga and the barriers to their active participation?
Well, as I understand it from being in India several times, from the Indian standpoint, from Krishnamacharya's standpoint, who I had the fortune, as you mentioned, to meet him, there are three stages of life for yoga. Shikshana, which I call young and restless. Mm-hmm. Rakshana, which I call the prime of life. And Chikita, which is more like when you have problems. And in India, the lifestyle is much different. People get married much younger and so forth. And in America now, this Rakshana stage has become much broader, much broader. So the thing is now, people don't like to be referred to as seniors. So it's not just the baby boomers. If you look at the life of a professional athlete, somewhere at the end of their 30s, and certainly by 40, they're out of the game. They can't compete like they used to. So they have to change what they do, how they do it. And it's the same with yoga. I mean, people at a certain stage don't want to jump all the time, you know? The people that spread yoga the most in America, BKS Iyengar, Patabe Joyce, they were 16 years old when they learned yoga, 16. So that same teacher, Krishnamacharya, later in life, he was always teaching new things, and he got his first Western male student somewhere in the late 60s, early 70s. He was the ambassador to India, Dr. Albert Franklin. And then Krishnamacharya started to teach differently. These are what I call the contemporary teachings of Krishnamacharya, and they were emphasized by his son, T.K.V. Deskachar. And that is the stage that I'm going for. Somewhere between 40-something and 70-something is the largest segment of our population. And again, it's not just the boomers. These are people who are doing things. They want to be active. And this is the prime of their life. So that is that's the largest segment of our population. And in my opinion, they are the most underserved, and especially men, because men do not like to look bad in front of women. And you look at the yoga classes, and they're packed with women and a few guys. And so now with Primal Life Yoga, they have the opportunity to feel like it's user-friendly and they're not going to get injured. So they've become very popular.
So that's an interesting, very interesting point that you're making over there about the age group from 47 to 77 and men largely being underserved and under, with lesser outreach. And of course, there are several reasons and barriers. And this is exemplified by the questions that we have received from some of our listeners. You know, a lot of these questions are, how long can one continue to practice yoga? Is it safe after the age of 60, 65? I'm 55 years old. How can I begin practicing yoga? So in a very nutshell, of course, you advocate practice for this. So what would you like to tell somebody who is in this age group to come to you and say how, if they want to practice yoga or if they want to get going, what would your response be and how would you motivate and inform them to actually get started on this path at this stage of their life?
Well, there's always politics of names. So, but the original name that Krishnamacharya and Deskachar gave this segment is called, the type of practice is called Vini Yoga. So that means that the yoga is adapted to the individual based on their age, their profession, their psychological, and all that stuff. But what's happened in America is that particular flavor or style really appeals to this midlife. And so some of the teachers of Deskachar, like myself, have, made our own spin on it, and mine is called Prime of Life, and my website is samatha.com, and there's lots of videos and things that people can get started with. I highly encourage people, especially the middle-aged people, like guys and women 50, 60, you can't believe the benefits you're going to get, and you don't have to do the hard yoga posture to get the benefits.
Guess we might be having difficulties in Dr. Payne's line.
I can hear you.
I think we just lost you for a few moments.
Did you get the part about how
you were talking about the website and it has all the videos?
Yes, and samatha.com. But there's definitely a kind of style, a way of doing yoga for people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And then after that, the new name in America is we don't use senior so much anymore. We use older adults. And that's for the people like in these assisted living. And then when they start doing like chair yoga. So in the book, Yoga for Dummies, all those stages are covered. Young and restless, prime of life, older adults, and with some samples for the people to do.
No, absolutely. I mean, I actually grew up in India, and, if you look at the Vedic lifestyle descriptions that we grew up learning about, it was your various stages of life. First 25 years of life, 25 to 50 years of life, then 50 to 75, and 75 to 100 years. So, it obviously makes sense that yoga would evolve as you age and with your body. And there was an article in the New York Times recently where many experts, including Dr. Lauren Fishman and an Iyengar teacher, Carrie O'Rourke, were quoted saying that the body changes, so you have to obviously transform your practice along with the needs of the body. So just to, very high level, take a case. Let's say somebody who has osteoporosis and, 65, male, and what are some of the high level things that you might consider in personalizing the practice for this person at that point of age, like in terms of frequency of practice, number of poses not to do or to do? So can you give us some idea about that?
I think in later in life, if people haven't been doing yoga, they're new to yoga at 50, 60, 70, the place where people often get hurt is in the inverted postures. So now there's lots of ways of supporting with blocks and wedges and things that feed up on the wall and like that to get the benefits. But I think they have to be careful if they, there's certain styles of yoga where you'll walk in the room and they'll put you in the headstand on the first day if you're 60 or 70 years old, because they have a cookie cutter course, one size fits all, and that doesn't do good for these older people. So you have to make sure you're in a class where you're not pushed into things. So in this stage of life, sir, there's more of a focus on the breath. There's more importance on function more than perfect form. So in other words, we suggest that the people have forgiving limbs that can soften their arms and legs, because it's the spine that we're trying to focus on. And also we find that for that stage, that moving in and out of postures before you hold them is beneficial for the joints in a lot of ways. then you know, the sequence is important. And all the yoga teachers on the panel are very good at this. They know that, you know, what people do after this or that. And then, especially in this segment, you want, you know, the more user-friendly postures. Now, that age bracket, osteoporosis, the standing postures, usually you do pretty good because, you know, you want to put some stress on the bones. And it's both osteoporosis and also what is called osteopenia, where you're almost there. And so they're finding weightlifting, standing yoga postures. Also, the standing postures are more forgiving. There's more of you that can move around and adjust and so forth. So that's just my off-the-top thoughts.
So I think getting to a little bit about back pain, and of course with old age and older adults, because of the aging in the body and also because of other conditions, back pain is a chronic and a common problem. And you have also dealt with it. And there are a lot of people like Lauren Frischman who actually specialize in using yoga as a treatment for back pain. Can you throw a little bit of light on what we know about treating back pain through yoga, and some of it through practice and some of it through scientific studies that show whether it works or it doesn't work and what kind of people it works in? So can you discuss a little bit about back pain?
Yeah, sure.
And
sure. Gary Krafsow, who is also a student of Desika Char, and his staff with physical therapists, have you know, done one or two studies that was printed in the Annals of Medicine on lower back. Did really well. Iyengar just had another one recently. Here's what we know about our lifestyle in America. We bend forward too much. So if you look at the life of the average person, you get up in the morning, you sit on the edge of the bed, you bend forward. You go into the bathroom, you take care of some type of business, and you sit and bend forward. You get ready to go out to work, you lean over the sink, you bend forward. When you get to work, there's a computer at your desk, and you bend forward. And when you get home at night, you answer your personal emails, so your eyes get blurry, and you bend forward. We bend forward too much. So what most people have with a back problem is what I would call flexion faults. Lumbar strain, disc, sciatica, all those things. Now, there's a lot of different kinds of back problems, and there are some people who have the opposite. But the majority of the people that I see, I would say 80, 90%, have something to do with the bending forward too much. So the kind of postures that we try to do is to even out, to get some type of extension in there. And also, by the time someone reaches 50, 60, 70, even 30 or 40, you've been right-handed or left-handed for a long time. So you need to do some asymmetrical type postures, working each side of the body separately. So all of the Eastern traditions, yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, even Pilates, they address that. So that's something that is important, to work each side of the body separately, and in the majority of cases, do something to help people with more arching if they can do it, and to have the knowledge to know what conditions that you can do that with. For instance, there's something called spondylolisthesis, where the vertebra has slipped forward and they can't bend backwards. But most people need to find some ways to arch a bit, either in the standing poses or the classic posture known as the cobra, and things like that. That's my overall opinion.
Thank you. And I'll actually bring in some of our panelists to weigh on this, including Marcella, and from a younger perspective, how to address some of these problems with that might happen from bending forward.
Oh, very good. I met DPS Iyengar, and I studied that system for almost 7 years, so it's a great system.
Actually, I do want to discuss your meeting with Krishnamacharya, and I've read on your Huffington Post blog that it was a very intimidating presence, and I'll get back to this before I want to bring on the panelists one by one. But before that, I do want to ask a little bit about, ask you to throw a little bit more light on what is Prime of Life Yoga, and what are the principles, and what do you teach in that, and what age group does it really apply to?
The Prime of Life Yoga is primarily for people 40-something to 70-something. You know, there's in Los Angeles, there's a lot of athletes, so there's still people 41, 42, 43, you could do a lot of things. But by about 45, the body really has changed, so the postures are narrowed down to more user-friendly postures. There is more of a focus on the spine, which I've mentioned before, the postures you move in and out of. And all the sequences and routines are very user-friendly. So it attracts men because they can do the pose. The difference between the Iyengar system, which again is a very good system, is we don't use as many props. I think because we've chosen simpler postures, it's not as necessary. But you know, you could say the wall is a prop, the floor is a prop, and certainly we use bolsters, straps, and things like that. Not as many, and also I think we draw more men and then other styles, sometimes you know, almost equal number.
It did lose you for a bit, but I think we can make the connection. We just lost you for a few seconds. But as you were saying, and Ms. BKS Iyengar has mentioned very clearly in his book, Light on Yoga, is that the wall is a great teacher. It's a great prop. And
yeah,
you know so much
is.
About it, just using the wall. So that is wonderful. Thank you so much for a wonderful introduction. And now what I'm going to do switch gears a little bit and bring on our panelists one by one. So bring on Marcella, who is a certified junior intermediate one Iyengar yoga teacher and is also on the core faculty of the Iyengar Yoga Institute of New York. Her yoga training includes various trips to India where she has studied with the Iyengar family, and she is also trained with Patricia Walden and Manuso Manos. Marcella is an ordained Tibetan Buddhist nun in the Saya tradition. She has completed various retreats here in the West and also abroad. She leads yoga and meditation retreats, in which I actually went to a few weeks back in Menla Mountain, upstate New York. So, Marcella, pleasure to have you on our show, and would love to have your thoughts on this topic and also discuss yoga for older age people with Larry and ask your questions.
Middle-aged.
Yes, that's all. Hello, Cyrus. How are you?
Yes. Good.
Hello.
Good.
So nice to meet you. I wanted to thank you both for inviting me on the show. It's a real pleasure, and it's a real honor to have the opportunity to share with different practitioners and speak about these topics that are so relevant, so important, and so meaningful in everybody's life nowadays. And I wanted to add a little bit to what we were just talking, what I was listening to about the forward bending syndrome that Dr. Payne described, how most of our activities involve this forward bending static position, and how one of the ways we address it, I think all yoga practices address it, is at least in the Iyengar method, we start out with standing postures and the standing asymmetrical postures for the reason that Dr. Payne was mentioning, where the asymmetrical postures stretch and move and tone one side of the body at a time. And it's a wonderful antidote for the asymmetrical sitting that so many of us spend so much of our lives in. And also, in our method, even though we do use props, what we're taught as teachers for the beginning students is actually to use as little props as possible so that the student learns to feel that the best prop is their own body, that they have everything they need for proper support, proper balance, and proper movement already built in. And then the props are introduced as a way to help them to get the maximum benefit of however far they can stretch or move or bend. And I also wanted to say, Dr. Payne, I've taken some Ashtanga classes, and it has been so nice to end a class and not have to clean up any props afterwards.
Marcella, we just lost you for a little bit. Looks like we're having a difficulty
in
the phone lines.
Okay.
Yeah.
We can hear you now. I can hear you. That's really cute.
Yeah.
Sarah, can I get my question now, or should I wait till later? You tell me.
No, no, please go ahead. Please go ahead.
Dr. Sharif, Dr. Payne, I wanted to tell you that I think your work addresses a much-needed combination of yoga and modern medicine. And
thank
I
you.
Love the work that you're doing with the free clinics and your program with the university. We're so lucky nowadays that it's even possible to Google an illness and come up with a yoga posture or a yoga sequence that can help us. The ancients had a word for what yoga practice is aimed at, which is the word chitta. It's a word for which there's no English equivalent, and perhaps the closest that we have in English is a phrase. I would think it's mind and heart, which refers to a person's mental and emotional experience. And the purpose of yoga, as I see it, is to cultivate that mental and emotional health and well-being. And when we practice yoga, the physical benefits are a wonderful side effect. And to me, it's a testament to the depth of yoga that we can practice it for its side effects and still have such great results.
Yes, totally agree, dear.
And I agree with you wholeheartedly that yoga offers benefits no matter what postures we practice or the stage of difficulty that we practice them in. And I agree that functional movement is very important and that breath and prana are vital to the way that we should learn asana. And that yoga gives prime of life people wonderful physical benefits. But no one need miss out on the ultimate promise of yoga, as I like to call it, no matter what their age. And it seems to me, Dr. Payne, that with the yoga, we have something very wonderful and very unique to offer people in prime of life as they live longer and healthier lives. I think we could do great benefit by helping them also to cultivate mental and emotional well-being at this time in their life so that they can face illnesses and aging and death. To me, this time of a person's life marks a period of growth, and sometimes midlife becomes a time of challenge, crisis, confusion, and perhaps even depression. I have students, and I see fit and healthy students in prime of life who are also afraid and confused and anxious about some of these issues, and I would like to help them. So I would welcome any input or appreciate hearing how you address these in your work.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, as I listen to your great remarks, and by the way, you've had the royal family of teachers.
Oh, yes.
All those people are wonderful and dear friends of mine, too.
Yep.
Yeah, Manuso, Patricia. So I think that, you know, a lot of what you said is very true, but as far as the people having these problems and so forth, one of the things we also have to remember as teachers is Krishnamacharya said that the most important aspect of healing is the relationship between the teacher and the students.
Yeah.
And so that the fact that you shed that light for them, that they trust you and they can talk to you, especially when we work with people one-on-one, that just being a good listener and also meeting them where they are so that they can feel okay about the fact that they can't do this, they can't do that. But if they can just breathe, you know, you can give them a practice. So I try to make people feel okay about where they are just like you do. And if they have issues, fine. But I think that link with you is one of the key things that we have to keep remembering. So we have to always be an example, you know, of the good aspects of yoga. And I think that these things you mentioned, they'll find, help from just the relationship with you as their teacher. That's my opinion.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I apologize that there's technical difficulty in the lines today and everybody's breaking up a little bit, but I believe for most part of it we are able to make sense of what's being spoken. But I want to add a little bit here, Dr. Payne and Marcella. Thank you for that insight, Marcella. And last time when we had David Emerson talk about using yoga to treat people with trauma, one of the things he mentioned, which I again here echoed in what Marcella was saying and what you said, is that the relationship between the teacher and the student, and how sometimes the teachers just have to listen or wait for the person to have the ability to think and plan and do the pose rather than necessarily have them just do the pose because they are being told to do a pose. And it was a really interesting insight that David mentioned in the last call, was that just letting the patients will it inside themselves to actually come into that pose. And that is a huge barrier that they overcome when they are, especially when they have faced trauma. So
I'd like to one more comment on just one other aspect that has come up. There is also, with the internet, there's a danger that, you know, people are going to go to the internet and they're going to see something and do it, and they may not choose the, you know, the person who has the knowledge. And because there's a lot of stuff on the internet, so the best thing is, you know, if they can align themselves with a good school like the Iyengar school or like the Vinyasa Yoga school or whatever, to make sure that's where they're getting their information, I think it's important. Also that we as yoga teachers, you know, we have boundaries, especially in the United States. The people sue people. You know, it's a litigious society.
Yeah.
And it's not so much in India.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, it helps us to work with other health professionals, I believe, to stay out of trouble.
So now with that, I will introduce our next panelist, Micheline, and who's an oncology counselor at Life with Cancer. In addition to being a licensed clinical social worker, she is a registered yoga teacher and a certified end-of-life counselor at Life with Cancer. She provides individuals, couples, and families counseling for cancer patients and their loved ones. She helped develop a six-week mind-body education series, leads yoga and meditation classes for patients and caregivers, facilitates support groups, and speaks to community groups about issues related to cancer. She has a particular interest in using mind-body practices to strengthen resiliency in cancer patients and their caregivers. Micheline, you are on air, and please go ahead and discuss the topic and ask your questions to Dr. Penn.
Thank you. It's just really delightful to be here. I feel like so much of what has already been said, I am just resonating with and really enjoying this conversation. I do work primarily in a healthcare setting. And Dr. Payne, when you were talking about legalese and lawsuits, I'm very familiar with the ramifications of doing things wrong there. We're very trigger happy in healthcare settings. I think one of the my primary sort of question I wanted to throw out there is not so much about the physical physicality. I'm getting a lot from what you're saying, but I have a question that I always struggle with around sort of conceptual, and this is sort of ego stuff, how we move through these different stages, wrestling with our ego. When I'm teaching classes to cancer patients, but I think this applies to everyone in sort of prime of life and beyond, the messages they're getting constantly are you have to fight this disease. You have to fight to get back to what you had, and, you know, this is what I think those of us in prime of life and beyond are constantly hearing. You want to fight to get something back. And, you know, I'm trying to work with modeling and creating scenarios where there's acceptance for the current moment, the current situation, just acceptance of what is. But I find sometimes there's sort of a struggle between that acceptance and hope for change.
I think what you said is very beautiful and very astute, and that it's really true. We have to take this with acceptance. You know, this thing about fighting all the time and so forth, we have to take it, you know, one day at a time, and acceptance is a big thing. I totally agree with you.
I'll jump in and I'll have Marcella actually add something here, because, you know, the whole language for the fight against cancer, whereas I mentioned, I was in a retreat where Marcella was there with, and there was other people who were talking about trauma of everyday life. Mark Epstein has written a book on this. and how we need to learn, and using Buddhist teachings and practices, that trauma is part of every life, and how do we accept that? How do we accept that suffering and then go beyond that? So, Marcella, would you like to add a little bit on that point, and especially from what we learned at the retreat just a few weeks back?
Oh, yes, of course. Thank you so much, Sharif. I feel like Micheline and I are asking a similar question worded a little differently, because when I was thinking about how to word my question, that word that she used kept coming back to me, that our society, our doctors, they're kind of telling us that we have to fight disease. And it can be very tricky to tell somebody who's sick to accept their illness without giving the message that, well, this is as good as it's going to get, so I'm sorry, I can't do anything more for you. You'll just have to be more like resign yourself to your fate rather than find creative and positive and constructive ways of being with what's happening in your body and your life. And midlife brings up a lot. It brings up menopause. It brings up, empty nest syndrome. It brings up, a red convertible. All these transitions that are possible growth times, but also can become a crisis for a person because they're starting to look at the rest of their life and at their mortality. So what we were talking about at the retreat was using the meditation technique of what Micheline was saying about being in the present moment and using that acceptance as a way to actually go on in a creative manner. Acceptance, I think, doesn't mean that there's nothing you can do about things. It means that when we stop fighting something, even on a cellular level, our body, our mind, can then turn towards creative energies, creative ways of thinking and working through things. Rather than, what you were saying, Micheline, trying to fight it. And with the meditation, a lot of it is really learning to be in the present, like she was saying, and the breath is one of the best ways to be in the present moment. The experience of body is also the present moment. The experience of our mind is not always present. It's either flashing back into the past or being in the world of the future. So that could be the experience of fantasy. So when Dr. Payne says breath and function and concentration, that really resonated with me, and it's being in the present moment. But exploring that idea of accepting, and also what Dr. Emerson said, which was that we can let people move in and out of the pose in the way that they choose, what Sharif was saying, to invite them, not to give them the order or to make them feel like they're being told what to do, but to teach them to be listeners of their own experience, something like that. I think awareness has a lot to do with it.
So thank you for that really, really interesting insights, folks. This was a very interesting, Micheline, for bringing this point up. And if you have other questions, please feel free to ask, and then we can bring on our other experts as well.
I'm fine hearing from other people as well. This is Micheline. Thank you. That was very helpful, Marcella.
Actually,
well,
definitely
thank you.
Amazing technical issues in the line
today. Sure,
let's
hear from somebody else.
Yeah. So I'll bring on Char Grossman, and Char has been very supportive of the Cure Panel talk show. Dr. Payne, we do hear you, and I'm bringing on our third panelist, Char Grossman, here. And
hi,
she's
Char.
A professional.
Hi, Larry.
We go
where are you from? Where are you from? I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, a good friend of Matt Taylor's, and Beryl Bender Burst said to give you a hug.
Oh, my gosh.
Helped me stand
up and stretch,
so that's a really good thing.
Those are my dear friends.
I know.
That's actually an interesting segue. Dr. Payne, where are you calling in from? It'll be interesting to just see where people are calling in from,
Los Angeles, mm-hmm. California, and actually the area called Marina Del Rey.
No, that's a nice area.
So you are calling from all different parts.
Right.
Yes. Marcella is calling in from New York, I believe, and Micheline, I don't know where you're calling in from, but yeah, we definitely... Mm-hmm.
From just outside Washington, D.C.
Oh, D.C.
I think Dashima is also in Los Angeles when she comes up.
Yeah, she. We haven't yet seen her on the call yet, but I believe she will dial in at some point. So, Char, she's a professionally recognized therapeutic yoga specialist and educational intervention teacher and also a psychologist. She has done her yoga training at Yoga Alliance and has obtained professional training at Duke Integrative Medicine in Yoga Awareness for Cancer and completed MD Anderson's Integrative Medicine Program's Oncology Training Conference. She founded Yoga Reach, and she's very interested in bringing yoga as a therapy to individuals of all ages and abilities. So, Char, you're on air for your questions and discussion.
Thank you. Thank you again, and hello to all of you.
Hello.
Larry, one of the things as far as my background goes, when I founded Yoga Reach, which is a program that utilizes all types of physical, mental, social competencies, anything that has to do with people that have special needs and medical challenges. So those are the types of people that I work individually and group-wise with. But these types of people are really no different than we are. But when they started with me, they were at a younger age. And now, like the rest of us, they've sort of reached middle age, midlife. And with that, their bodies have changed. Even if they started off with the movement problems to begin with, now they have them even to a more extensive situation.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, at this point, they're not as flexible as they were. They may not have balance techniques. The strength isn't there. You know, I keep trying to get them to come up with different ways that, honestly, with the acceptance, that they can believe in themselves, that they can do anything. That, you know, no matter what type of disability, if we have one you have, still get your finger to move a little bit. Or when you get energy through your body, you know, it helps you mentally just know that, wow, I can do things. I can believe in myself. Again, like Marcella and Micheline talked about, that, you know, things do occur on an everyday basis and let's live in the present. I agree with that wholeheartedly. But I want to know if you have some suggestions as far as just different types of strategies that might be really beneficial to the type of population that does have medical challenges, be it like stroke survivors, Parkinson's, people with special needs, you know, and other types of disabilities.
Well, you know, that's a lot of people, and, you know, to say something broad in general, I would say the key thing is to let go of perfect form. Focus more on function.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, what is the function of doing this? You know, because we, in our early stages, we learned yoga to have very good form, which was good at that stage because that's what they wanted people to do, pay attention, and, you know, you're forming and growing just like an Olympic athlete or something. But at this stage, you know, the body's pretty set. So if you try to, you know, ask people to do things that require perfect form, then it can get in trouble. So more like about function. I think it's also incredible that you and a couple other people on the panel have professional licenses as well. This is uplifting the status of yoga. This is what we try to do at the Ayala Marymount University. All the teachers are, you know, they have the license of professionals. And the more we can make a bond, a link with integrative medicine, especially for these problems that we share, I think that it's great for the future of yoga.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's very interesting, these points, like not just focus on form, which is what normally we would associate, you know, looking at all these glossy publications, as you said, that this is the perfect state that we want to achieve. but forgetting in that process that the process is as you say, the experience of the journey is as good as, is better than reaching the destination. So in that, you know, putting it in that context, but also wanted to add something that I've personally been reflecting on, and it's coming from some of Sufi and Islamic teachings that I've been hearing about and thinking about, and that is, even before function, the fact that you can create an intent and have an intent, a very explicitly stated intent in your mind that you're doing this something, and you're doing this as per Sufi and Islamic practices, doing this for the divine and for the presence of the divine, or in the presence of the divine, or to express gratitude for the divine energy that is all around us, that in itself can be a solid preparation for us to do the function, to finally get into the form. And as I hear you, Oliver, we talk about it, I just think that bringing that element out in the practice and somehow communicating that intent, function, experience all lead to that form is part of the yoga process would be a very interesting way to address the practice. And I would like to hear your thoughts on this.
It's a good comment. The challenge we have is with people that feel like that might be religious or something. You know, it's not to us. And certainly has a great value. But what we find with the lay public is even something like chanting or any of these things like that, often there are people who have resistance to things like that. So when you start saying about connecting to the divine and all this, I mean, it's perfect for the people who are into yoga and yoga circles. But when the people come from the outside, when they have problems, they've never been in yoga, they just come for yoga as a therapy or something like that, you'll see it as an issue come up, just from my experience of a lot of years there. But I think it's a beautiful point.
So we finally have Dashama in the call, and as she always manages to make it.
Hi.
Dashama, can you? Yeah, we can hear you. So good to have you back on the show. I know you've always had trouble dialing in. Last time your phone got dropped in the ocean in Bali, but you still made it. So we really appreciate that. And a big hi from everyone.
Hi, everyone. I was actually in a conference, and so I just got done.
So we actually just wanted to introduce you quickly and have you discuss your question with Dr. Payne. Dashama is, Dr. Payne, you know her well, but for the listeners, I would like to just quickly summarize that she's a yoga and fitness expert with 10-plus years in the industry, training, coaching, and consulting clients and companies. She definitely is a creative dynamo, doing multimedia production with videos, books, DVDs, which have been featured on Oprah.com, Walmart, Barnes & Noble, Target, and a wide following of more than 8 million views on YouTube. So, Dashama, please go ahead. And thank you so much for being here.
Let me just throw one other thing. She's a hell of a dancer, too.
Wow.
Oh, that's...
Thank you, Dr. Mary.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I had such a privilege to be present with Dr. Larry Payne in California during one of his book launches, actually, and I'm just honored to know you. And the question that I was thinking about had to do with addiction, actually, because I've had a lot of people in my life come, and I think that yoga can be so powerful for healing and overcoming addictions. And I just love to hear your feedback if you have any experience in that with yoga. And I know that yoga and meditation and mindset and replacing negative habit patterns with positive yoga and healthy patterns is really a good way to go. But if you have anything that you could contribute as far as solutions and techniques, anything in that regard, it would be a big blessing, I feel.
Well, you know, we have in our the Yoga Therapy RX course at Loyola Marymount, we have a teacher, Robert Bernberg, who was once an addict, and then he's now a recovering drug person, and he also became an expert in the Yoga Sutra. So he has a lot of great information relating the Yoga Sutra, Patanjali from yoga, with the 12-step program. And so I think it's helpful. And what I've sat in on many of his conferences, and you know, there are certain stages of addiction where people just don't want to do yoga. I mean, and you can't push them or force them, you know, it's like they're in this particular stage. But when they're ready, we also find that being in nature is very helpful, and you do that a lot. You take people to Bali, you here and there. Another person who has started a program that's an outpatient program in Los Angeles that has a way to help with the immune system because it's way down is the Dr. Leroy Perry at the International Sports Medicine Institute. And I think because you're in Los Angeles, I'm happy to introduce you to him. He's got quite a program going there with several MDs, and this is like an outpatient type of thing. And then he refers to yoga teachers and so forth. So what I've learned about it is there are just certain stages of addiction where, you know, the yoga has to be at the right time. Otherwise, you know, they have a hard time doing almost anything. You know, there's just this period of time when they're having a hard time with that. And you would be a perfect person to motivate people when they're ready for the yoga practice. But I would just say that it depends on what stage they're in, and also their age and all these things. And I think that they've got to get their chemistry, you know, better, you know, and their immune system better, so that if you want me to put my two cents in, you know, that is a great way to support what you're doing. And I'd like to connect you to Dr. Perry in Los Angeles. I think you guys would work out well together.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. I really appreciate it. Thank you for
your... Sure. Pleasure.
So we just have a little bit of time left, and I do want to bring in a few of the questions that listeners have submitted. They're all sort of falling under a couple of categories. One is people want to know what yoga poses to do with certain conditions, and I think we have mentioned a little bit about osteoporosis. But Dr. Payne, is there anything that is specifically recommended or prescribed or to be avoided for people who have glaucoma? And should they be doing yoga postures like headstands, inversions? Have you had some experience and can throw some light on this? Because I think this is a question that I haven't seen this come before. So I thought it would be interesting to bring it up.
This also falls in the category of something called retinopathy. So there's something in the eye like eye disease, glaucoma, high blood pressure, all those things. And definitely, inversions are not recommended. There's even some stages of diabetes where the organs start to degenerate, you know, advanced diabetes, where you have to be careful of that as well. But I want to come back to, you know, the magazines like to say...
Long
what
pause
pose
there,
do you do?
Doctor.
The magazines like to say, what pose do you do for this? And, you know, I know all of the teachers on the staff understand... There's no one pose that's going to fix somebody with something. You know, it depends on the person, and it's usually the fact that they're doing a practice that's going to help their whole system. It's not like you say, this is the pose you do to fix this or fix that. It's like it's usually a practice that fits that person. And, of course, certain poses we know, but I think it's better to know the ones not to do. Just like you said, that was brilliant. What do you avoid? And, you know, that is definitely what you mentioned, that particular problem is you have to be careful of inversions, definitely. Maybe some of the other people would like to weigh in on that.
Yes.
I don't want to be a hog of the show, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Marcella, Micheline, or Dashma, any of you have dealt with patients with glaucoma or retinopathies and would like to throw some light on this?
I was just to say, I think anybody who has that especially should avoid inversions, but there are things that I've heard about people taking that helps to relieve some of that glaucoma, especially nutritionally, and then as you can maybe alleviate that actual issue. I've seen people overcome the entire disease, and then potentially they can reapproach doing things like inversions eventually. So I think addressing the problem And then I've seen people actually heal that and then go on to being able to do things that are like inversions without a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I will move to the next class. And again, in this we have 5-6 questions, and I think Dr. Payne and Marcella, we might be able to summarize. For people with age-related joint issues, osteoporosis, arthritis, what are some of the three things to be very mindful of when practicing in terms of making sure your balancing is right, you're not putting too much pressure on your bones, which are already becoming a little brittle. So, Dr. Payne, what are the three things in your experience that you recommend to patients with age-related chronic joint diseases, arthritis, osteoporosis?
Well, again, I would say to avoid the real difficult postures, you know, the ones where you're really twisting yourself into a pretzel, that, you know, you don't need to do those postures.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we come back to the standing postures as a way, you know, you have to put a little weight bearing on the joints. And second, I would say that I always come back to those. I think that it does not hurt to link up with the medical or the alternative health community for supplements or medicine. You know, I'm not against taking medicine. There are certain things that complement us well, and it's just knowing, you know, the right doctors. You know, the ones who have the medical training, and they also open to more like holistic ideas and not taking a lot of meds and things like that. But I think that would be the third element I'd recommend. Is some type of supplemental medication if necessary.
Marcella, any insights into that? Have you worked with patients with any of these issues?
Yes, Sharif. Yes, I also wanted to make a comment about the glaucoma question, because I have worked with someone, in fact, at the Institute. She's a young woman, and she goes for tests, I think, twice a year. And a few years after working with her, the tests that are done on her, I'm not a specialist, but she tried to describe it to me, and it's something that measures how much pressure is felt in the eye. And she told me that after doing yoga for a couple of years, that had gone down a lot. And
beautiful.
Yeah, this was amazing. And we had a specialist come into our school who's teaching us teachers how to work therapeutically with students. And I remember one of the things that we were taught is to teach the student to feel, to be very sensitive to how much pressure they feel in their eyes, in the back of their eyes, in their temple, and in their brain, not only during inversions, but at any other posture, say triangle pose, where the head is taken off to the side. And all kinds of adjustments can be made where the head is supported so that she can stretch her spine and not have any weight there. And she can do some inversions. What we do sometimes is we wrap her head with a band, and that seems to diminish the pressure in her eyes. But it really is a week-to-week, month-by-month situation. I just wanted to say that about three things that I would tell people. I would say one thing was what Dr. Payne said, is let go of the way the poses look in the book and work on how understanding how your body functions and how the poses bring up proper functional movement. That would be one thing. I would say also look, feel your skin, feel your eyes. Does your practice, the way that you do it, does it make you hot? Does it dry out your eyes? Does it make you sweaty? And that's also a good indicator of how the practice is going. And also find a teacher that you can talk to and that you can listen to. And that you feel if there's, like with Dr. Payne, what you told me, in fact, if there's good communication between you and your teacher, then you'll feel comfortable about talking to them. You won't feel self-conscious or limited in any way about exploring what works for you with your issues in your practice with your teacher.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're in the last couple of minutes, and I want to address quickly two short questions, rapid fire, and then I want to end the call with asking Dr. Payne something about his experience with Krishnamacharya. So, Micheline and Char, you might be able to answer this. Have you ever worked with a patient who has multiple myeloma, blood cancer that can affect spinal vertebrae and fracture them? If there are any kind of yoga poses or any other therapy sequences you have worked with any patients in that space?
I haven't worked with any patients specifically diagnosed with that, but what I simply do as far as looking at a patient, be it they've cancer, stroke survivors, et cetera, is you have to individualize, as Larry and the rest of you have talked about. But it really helps to show them the pose, but to show them the pose maybe in the chair, maybe against the wall, maybe lying on the floor, maybe standing up. So I sort of take it from that angle, and then whatever is possible, whatever the person can do, that I think is, you know, going to be extremely beneficial to them.
This is Micheline.
Yeah.
Can I just add one thing to that? I agree with what was just said. I also feel really strongly. I've worked with many patients with multiple myeloma, other blood cancers, and I really direct them to get clear information from their oncologist as to what they're not supposed to be doing. You know, I don't think that yoga teachers should be playing doctor when that's not
amen,
my life.
Amen.
So, I feel very strongly like really getting them to have that conversation with their oncologist or their physician. You know, what should I not be doing? What should I stay away from and what can I do? So, that's my two cents.
I can hear Dr. Payne wanting to add something here. Please go ahead. Amen. Okay,
amen.
That's good. We have more questions, but I think we'll be totally out of time now. But I do want to obviously thank all of you for a wonderful discussion. But before we end, Dr. Payne, tell us how it was to meet Krishnamacharya. Like, I mean, he's the father of modern yoga. Tell us a little bit, like, what was the energy? What was the, how did you, what was the conversation? Some anecdote, something.
The first time that I met him, I still was officially with the magazine, so I had a press card and I was doing a book and all this. And all of the other people through India went out of their way to accommodate me. He was not impressed. he was just like, he's not impressed by anybody from the press or anything. And when he finally met me, he looked at me like, who are you, you know? And then later I came back, and his son, this was after he broke his hip. So he was in bed with a hip fracture for many years. And he was totally different to me, and his son asked me to do a tribute to him. So I did the first tribute to Krishnamacharya in America, and what I want to say is that for those of you on this staff, it's been so kind, if you just send me an email, I'd like to send you a copy. I made a vintage, I went back and found this from 1987 and made it into a vintage video, and all these people are there, like Indra Devi, his students, and they're talking, and Deskacharya's prime. It's really nice, and I think there's nothing more than that that shows you the depth of this man and how his teaching changes, and Deskachar was on the spot, you know, because he had to say, well, yeah, he did teach like that then, and now he teaches like this, and it was always evolving. But it was truly an honor, and he was so kind to me, and then he blessed me, and he blessed this tribute in Los Angeles, California, and I was one of the greatest moments of my life, is to meet him and to do this for him. So. Anyway, for all of you on the panel, if you send me an email, I'm happy to send you one. It's a vintage thing that we redid, and it's not like watching Homeland, but it's pretty good.
Absolutely. It'll be a pleasure to get a copy of the DVD on Krishnamacharya. I mean, it's definitely a vintage.
And for all of you, if you just send me an email, I'm happy to send it.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And what a great
thank
job
you,
you've done on the, as a panelist, you know, as a host. Thank you very much.
Well, it's just a pleasure and a privilege to be able to have you all and talk to and actually learn from Marcella, who's my teacher, and have other panelists on the show. And I saw a little humble effort to, you know, increase awareness about yoga and discuss important topics and also bring it from the perspective of experience and research and people who are doing this so that there's a meaningful discussion from all the angles. Yeah. Thank you all, everyone. And our next panel.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and Marcella, Micheline, Dashama, and Achar, we have the next panel, all listeners, November 7th with Dr. Carol Horton, and we'll be discussing yoga and another important topic. So thank you all very much. I'll send, have Priya send you all the recording for this conversation, so you can put this on your websites and blogs and other places. Thank you once again. Namaste.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.